Good morning.
Morning.
I'd like to open with my favorite verse in the Bible, which I believe is the most important verse in the Bible. In the ancient world, there's one particular verse in the Bible that ancient listeners would have heard and gone, "Oh my goodness, that's Jesus's last will and testament." It uses a Greek phrase which you use when you're about to bequeath all your gear. And I think when there's a reading of a will, it reads the heart of the person who wrote it. Being of sound mind and body, I used up all my money, so none of you can have any of it. Whatever it is, it reveals your posterity, what you wanted to leave. And this particular verse is the last will and testament of Jesus Christ. Can you turn me down a little bit, please? And it speaks about the motive for the creation of the world. It speaks about the end of the world. And it reveals the motive inside of Jesus, which is inside of the Trinity, for why everything since "Let there be light" happened. In fact, it reveals the motive for "Let there be light." And it's a motive that none of us can ever come to terms with until we're glorified. We will never comprehend and truly trust and believe in the true motive of God in the creation of the world, because we can't believe it. Since Adam, since the fall, by nature, we cannot believe this verse, except imperfectly. We're still carrying two natures. And the verse is John 17:24. It's in Jesus' high priest's prayer in the upper room. And it reveals the motive of the universe. And it reveals why God said, "Let there be light." Father, I desire that those you have given me may be with me where I am, to see my glory that you have given me, because you loved me from before the foundation of the world. In the beginning, God was full to the brim and utterly happy. And that is not an experience we have ever had for more than 2 minutes in our lives. And all of God's works and all of God's plans and all of his wisdom come out of absolute, utter happiness and complete, eternal, full to the brimness. What he wants from us is nothing. He wants nothing from us. He wants nothing from anything, because he is complete and eternal and eternally intimate, eternally full of joy. He's rich beyond conception. And his motive for creating the world is so that he could have creatures to bring inside his own living room to share in the party. The Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit have eternal dancing. They never stop being thrilled and being drowned in joy. And they said one day, let's invite a few billion sentient beings who we will have to create into our living room so that they can enjoy our family. And we'll have kids. And you know what? We're going to have to get a bride for the boy one day. You know? And so out of that absolute abundance and richness and fullness and joy and magnanimity, God leaned forward and Jesus said, "Let there be light." And the Spirit made it so. Christy, would you come and play for me for a minute? We're going to have a little bit of an introduction to Bach. So you've got a couple of pieces that... This is 100% unrehearsed. And here we go. There's a couple of pieces that you mentioned that came to mind about Bach's genius and his beauty. Could you tell us about them a little?
Well... One of the pieces that really came to mind is one that's actually in three parts. It's a prelude to a partita, and it's in three very distinct parts, and they all have very different styles. It's in the key of C minor, and it starts out with kind of a chordal, kind of like a hymn section, with rolled chords, and it's very dramatic. It's in the key of C minor, which is kind of a very bold key, so it goes. So that's how it starts out.
What happened there?
Well, it's just some very strong chords, a very basic progression of chords, but they're... you know, they've got that, the arpeggiated roll going on, which makes it even more dramatic. And it sets you up for something. Oh, what's going to come next?
There's a spooky chord, and then there's a tension chord.
Right. And then it kind of resolves.
It comes back to the spooky chord.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay. And another
And then the next section of this prelude, after, it's not real long. I don't have the music, and it's been about 20 years since I've played this, so I don't remember all of it. But that section goes on for maybe about half of a page, about four lines, and then it goes into this.
What did you hear? What features did you hear in that?
Joy.
Joy. Yeah. Musicians. What did you notice about the music there?
Something was going on. Something creative was going on.
Yes. There's a creation of an emotion or something, a story.
A story was advancing. That's what
yeah.
I'm
Anything else?
Lightness.
Mm-hmm.
There was like a melody line, you could follow it.
Yes. So there was a melody. What else was there?
A harmony.
Very, very simple. Just one note.
There was one person who was speaking this dung, 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 and the other person was dancing with them and then dancing between their steps. So you'd hear the one voice, and then the little twinkly bit, and then the first voice, and they go back and forth. Listen to them talking. Can you play that again? Mm-hmm. Listen to the conversation between these two people. So they were talking together for a while, and then they started going, my turn, your turn, my turn, your turn, really, really quickly. Back, forward, back, forward. And anything else that is going on there?
Yeah, that's really the main thing. It's a simple melody. And what's interesting about it is it's still in the key of C minor, and of course minor is, you know, it's kind of spooky, kind of sad, But the first section is a completely different picture. But this is actually very pretty. So it's minor, but it's not necessarily sad, I don't think. It kind of dances a little bit.
Yeah. And then the third bit.
Okay. I'm not sure how much I can remember here, but okay. This, I'll play it then. Obviously, that's faster, so I need some practice at that. But that's a very basic. It's a fugue. It starts out with that melody line, and then you come in with it in the left hand.
What's a fugue?
A fugue. it's basically it's the same melody that's going on. Well, I guess another word for it would be counterpoint, but it's the same melody going on. It's kind of like a round, really.
Mm-hmm.
So you're just starting it, you know, a few measures later in a different part. And actually, at one time I played a five-part fugue, which had five different parts going on, and I could not play that for you by memory.
Yeah. Now, tell me if I'm right here. A round is where you sing a verse, and then you sing the same verse, but somebody else sings a harmony over it, which is a slightly different melody, and the two melodies fit together. And then the third group come in, and they sing the second harmony. And so you've got three people all singing different lines, but they're all in the right chords.
Right.
Whereas a fugue is about 100 times harder than that to write and to imagine, because
right.
You've got...
Well, this is a two-part fugue. You have two parts going on at once, and then there are three-part, four-part, mm-hmm. five-part, there's even a six-part.
And a fugue is where you have a melody, and then you have the harmony or the melody again, but you started at the wrong point.
Right.
And then, so they're more juxtaposed, and then you start it again, or you start a third harmony, but you started at the wrong point. And so this one's actually starting at bar 8 or bar 16 instead of bar 1. So it's like a...
It's very complex. Yeah.
Right. And now, Bach wrote five-part fugues, where he has five melodies that are all synchronizing in chords, but the patterns are actually all split over time, running on top of each other, and the music can't stop. It keeps going round and round like a wheel within a wheel. And then he wrote some inverted fugues,
yes.
Where he plays the music backwards.
Right, or it's basically inverting there are different ways to invert a fugue, but that would be one way to just like do it backwards.
And then you can play the fugue with the beat, instead of bub-up-bub, you'll play the thing with the bub-bub-up. So he'll reverse the rhythm,
mm-hmm.
and then play one, two, three, four, five layers with the rhythms back the front, with the melodies in the tonic or the first harmony or the second harmony, or further up.
Yes.
Five times up descant and so on. Okay, could you please finish with the little piece that you were thinking of playing out of that music there? Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. What could you hear? Did you hear some of the things we were talking about? What could you hear? Tell me some.
The baseline melody.
The baseline and the melody talking to each other. That was only a two-part. That was really simple. Keep going. What were how fast were the two people walking and talking together relative to one another?
One was much faster.
One was chattering and one was walking.
Sometimes they caught up with each other and were in sync with one another.
Yes. They would get in and then they would go out.
It was like one was dancing around. As one was walking slowly, one was dancing around the other one.
Yes. And so the baseline would be more like the root, and the other person was dancing in front of them and then behind them, and then the bass line would echo the melody line.
It always sounded good.
Big fun?
It always sounded good.
It always sounded magic. And
the bass line got some friends after a while.
Yes. The bass line started getting a third person who would play a third up. Was it a third up from the bass, or the boom, boom, and the other person was singing a third or higher and walking along the piano with them.
They would be following each other, and one wouldn't be playing like a melancholy sound, and one wouldn't be doing like the happy thing. They would be complimenting each other and going where the other voice went. Like if it started to get melancholy, you know, the little change in the bass line would create a change in the higher, you know,
yes,
voice. And then they would kind of crescendo and meet in one place, and then go back down into the more melodic sound.
Yes. Yes. Do you notice that at one point the melody goes da 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 da, and then it'll go da 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 da, it repeats itself, and then it kicks into a minor key and plays the same shapes, but they're in a minor key. So the order, if your fingers are pretty much moving the same way, but it's all suddenly spooky instead of bright and happy, but the shape's the same. This is only a two-part. Bach, this is like when Bach was sleeping, this is what he would play out the side of the bed. Oh, by the way, did anybody notice that the music was beautiful?
Yeah.
Wasn't it just beautiful? You just wanted to die or become part of the piano. I find sometimes with some music you say, this is so beautiful, I could die. Or, I just want to... I was listening, we heard a jazz band recently, and I just so desperately want to get up and run and burst into the band and say, give me one of those instruments, let me have a turn, let me play, let me be part of this. Oh, by the way, I'm a lousy musician. Don't turn the microphone off, but just let me be inside of what is happening. Just then I was thinking about, if I could get inside the piano and feel this through my bones. It's like,
we felt we were at a wedding.
Yes, yes, yes. And this is only a two-part. And the third. That was God's idea. God created us so that among other things, one day Christy could sit at a piano and we could listen to a quick few snippets of what a fugue is about and how Jesus' joy of man's desire works, and that we could taste the beauty. And we don't even have the capacity hardly to taste the beauty without learning it. So we did a little bit of chord theory and about how rounds work and how fugue works, and then when you heard it the last time, some of you went like, oh yeah, there's the two parts and they're talking to each other. And so even the capacity to taste the beauty is something that we don't by nature have. We have to learn that. You have to learn Bach for 150 years before you can go, oh, and then as you learn it, as you learn something like this, you want to play it to people and nobody's interested. And so you kind of finally get somebody that says, can you tell me why this music is affecting me like this? And you go, ah! Finally somebody has an ear that they want to hear and they want to know what this is about. Let me play to you for 17 hours. And you finally found a victim. This is dust compared to what it is to be the Father and the Son and the Spirit. They have music of this world, the likes of which this world cannot dream. But they have determined that to create us so that we can enjoy radical beauty. That's the motive of the universe. And that's what Jesus is saying in John 17:24, is that I want, that's the I desire is the will formula, I want those you have given me, see these people here? These are my present. These human beings are a love gift from my dad to me. And I want to bring them all home so they can be with me, they can be at home with us, so that they can hear Jesus' joy of man's desire, which you gave me because you loved me before the foundation of the world. And they don't even know how to hear music yet. I mean, this is only human music. Since the fall, we can't even hear heavenly music. So we have to be trained, and so we get the scriptures to awaken us to the real music. And so this is where Jesus is saying, this is the destiny that I have for these people is the destiny that I came from. I want to get them home. And why do I love them? Because I made them. But why did you make them? So that I could love them. But why did you need them? I didn't need them. This is not about us getting worship. This is not about God getting glory. This is not about God getting his bucket filled. Our bucket is full. We don't have an ulterior motive for the creation. We don't have one. And so last night, someone was talking about a person who was told the gospel, and they said, no, it's too easy. There's got to be an ulterior motive. Where's the hatch? Where's the earnings? Where's the exchange? Where's the economics? There's got to be some economics in the creation of the world. Why did God... When we ask the question, why did God create the universe? We're wanting some reason. And Jesus, and the Father and the Son and Spirit, they don't... Reason is something down here. We wanted to. Because we want to get you home. We want to take you home. And in the verse before this and the verse after it, the verse before says that they are loved, that the Christians, the disciples, and it's actually talking not about disciples, but about all Christians. Father, I want them, those you've given me, not only those here, but those who will come after, to be with us where I am, to be made one, the way that you and I are one, that they would be made one. So the union between the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit, who are one God and three persons and one God, Jesus explicitly prays that we will experience that. And then he says, because you have loved them, he's speaking to the Father has loved us with the love with which you loved me before the world began. So, listen to this. Is it heresy or not? The Father loves you as much as he loved the Son from before the foundation of the world. Nah, that can't be true. Because that would be, like, what would be the reason for that? What would be the ulterior motive for that? You know? It can't be that the Father loves me with the love that with which he loved Jesus before the world was made. Do you notice it can't compute? It's like if that computed, we would all collapse and be unable to breathe for a day. And we can't compute it because it's too good to be true. It's too good not to be true, because it couldn't be invented under the sun. Nobody could imagine that the truth about the universe could be that good. And so I want to take you through this next few days through the scriptures, looking at the scriptures through this lens, through the last will and testament of Jesus. Because that's how he saw the world. That's why he was here. That's what he was doing. He said, what am I doing here? I'm getting them home. I'm going to get them home, and they are going to taste bark cubed to the 15th. And so we're going to go through the Old Testament, New Testament 8 times, from beginning to the end 8 times. And each time I want to get you to put these lenses on, and with the other lens we're going to look at one particular theme. We're going to run through 8 times. This morning, most of this morning, we'll be talking about the macro history of the world, which is the macro history of the Bible. And so we're going to do the top line, which is the time hooks for the eras of the Bible. And in the beginning, God was full to the brim and completely happy. And so he said, let there be light. And we have our first slide, which is the 7 days of creation. And he created the 3 divisions: light, dark, sea, sky, earth, water. And then the next days, 4, 5, 6, he filled them. And he didn't just fill them. He filled them hyper abundantly. It says when you put fish in the sea, he didn't just put fish in the sea. He made the sea teeming with fish. And how many species did he invent, by the way? One 5/6 of all species that ever existed are already extinct. And how many species are there of things on Earth? This is like some number with a gazillion on the end of it. And God figured, you know, if I'm going to do this, I'm going to do this well. And he filled the universe and he filled the planet with abundance. One of the wonderful things is that everything that God made is moving. If you go right down to the bottom and you look at atoms, atoms are doing this at the speed of light. Every atom in the universe, I'll tell you the number about that later, every atom in the universe is spinning at the speed of light in a dance of internal gravity, and is dancing with every other atom and molecule in the universe. The molecules, hydrogen and oxygen, actually dance, and they're exchanging electrons. Because he wants them to spin. And then when he makes galaxies and clusters of galaxies, what are they all doing? And I believe that in the planetary system, the planets, as you come out from the sun, Mercury is spinning this way, and then Venus is spinning that way, and then Earth is spinning that way, and then Mars is spinning that way, and every single one of them has a different rotational system, all opposites on the way out. Because he was just having a good day, and he's playing. And how big will we make this show? Yeah, well, let's make at least pathetic underestimation, at least 1 billion galaxies per person who ever existed. Let's splurge. And we're going to make everything move and everything dance, and then in the ecosystems of the DNA world, we're going to make every single ecosystem, every single being exist dancing inside an ecosystem. So there's no such thing as a self-contained organism, because every organism is attached to every other organism and needs the other organism for oxygen or light or food or nutrition. And so every single thing is going to dance. Every single thing has to dance with every single other thing on the planet. Why? What do you think the Trinity do all day? They're the Father and the Son and the Spirit, and their thoughts do what that music was doing. One of them thinks the thing, and the other one thinks the thing in a third, and the other one thinks the thing in the fifth, and then one of them inverts the melody and one inverts the meter, and that's what they do. And so they make every single thing in the universe dancing. And then when they get to Adam and Eve, they're really warming up, and they make the garden in chapter 2, and say, what do we put in the middle of the garden? Let's put four rivers coming out of springs so that they never stop. And the four rivers of the world at that time, with different geography, go north, south, east and west. And they're not a spring like in the mountains. They're a spring like, there's four rivers flowing out of this thing. So there's endless, endless moisture and fertility for the soil and the lands here and there. And then in this land there was gold and it is good. And then over here, there's the precious stones of onyx. And gold and onyx then show up in the temple with Moses, because the temple is an allusion to Eden. And God fills the world, and he says that the trees, he filled the place with beautiful trees. And it says beautiful, underlined. And then he says that they were delicious for eating, all of them. And then he says in Hebrew, you may akal akal, which means eating squared. You may pig out. Except that wouldn't work for the Jews. But you know what I mean. And so he floods Eden for this for his children. He floods it with stuff. With water and with gold and with onyx and with beautiful things of beauty. And things that are delicious. And he puts them there, and he gives Adam the honor of naming everything. I'm going to give you the capacity of language that we in the Trinity have, and I'm going to get you to enjoy the speaking and the naming, and you're going to be a creator like me. And so Adam gets to name and articulate and describe and word and express every single thing. And God says, it's not good for you to be alone. And out of his side, he draws Eve, and he brings Eve to him face to face. Not subordinate, not over, not under, not sideways, face to face, brings him to his face. And he utters the first human words of poetry in the history of the world, which is the first thing that humans speak is poetry. And, you know, the flesh of my flesh, bone of my bones, she shall be named woman, for out of man she was taken. That's an awkward translation. In an Australian translation, that would come across as hurly burly, what a girly. And then he says to them, he blessed them. He pronounces his blessing on them. He says, I bless you. Everything, everything, everything is yours. Everything. Here it is. He anoints them. He appoints them as the owners of everything. They inherit everything on their birthday. Go forth and multiply. Fill the earth. Subdue it. All the creatures are yours. I give them all into your hand. Oh, by the way, I'm going to plant a paradise. Zoroastrian loan word for a pleasure garden. If you were filthy rich in the ancient Middle East, you would be wealthy enough to own a pleasure garden, and it would be an architectural garden. You'd plant all the fantastic trees in it and so on. He says, you're going to be here. You notice that the Lord God walks in the cool of the day. Ancient Middle East, they didn't have air conditioners. If you were wealthy enough, you would have a pleasure garden, probably hedged or walled. And in the cool of the day, when the stinking hot sun's gone, you would go out into the cool in the breeze with the pond and the pleasure garden and enjoy your barbecue with your family, because that's your space. And he walked with them in the cool of the day. They were his kids. Can you have a look in Genesis? I want you to read this and find it for yourself. Genesis 1, verse 26. Chris, could you read that for us?
Then God said, "Let us make man in our image and our likeness, and let them rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air, over the livestock, over all the earth, and over all the creatures that move along the ground."
The very first phrase, listen up, listen.
"Then God said, let us make man in our image,
in our likeness." That's it. Hear that? "Let us make man." This is the Father and Son Spirit talking in plural. "Let us make man in our image, in our likeness." Okay? And then the verse after what you read, "Fish over the sea, rules of the air," and then...
"So God created man
in his own image.
In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them."
Why did it take two sexes to image God? Well, he's a plural who is a one. He's a plural who is a one. And so it takes a 2-to-1 to image a 3-to-1. So of course it takes two. Because it's about dancing. He's imaging himself, so he's going to make us exactly like him. In that we are two, become one. Become two, become one. Become two, become one. And so please now turn to Genesis 5. Ryan, you got a book? You got a Bible? Christian, can you read Genesis 5:1 for us? Listen to the language really carefully.
"This is the book of the generations of Adam. When God created man, he made him in the likeness of God."
Oh, hear that? When God created man, he made him in the likeness of God. Next verse.
"Male and female, he created them, and he blessed them, and named them man. They were created."
So he's likeness, blessed, and he's named them. Yeah? Next verse, please.
"When Adam had lived 130 years, he fathered a son in his own likeness, after his image, and named him Seth."
Do you hear that? Can you read that again? Listen.
"When Adam had lived 130 years, he fathered a son in his own likeness, after his image, and named him Seth."
Listen to the language. It's very clear. It's tagging out of Genesis 1. God created us in his likeness and his image and named us. After 120 years, whatever, 130 years, Adam fathered a son in his likeness and his image, and he named him. What was the name? Seth. In your Bible, who is Seth's grandfather? Is it in the Bible? It's really there. Just in case it's not super clear, can someone look up Luke 3, verse 36? Can someone call it out? It's a little tedious from 36. Who's got it? Luke 3:36.
"Son of Canaan."
Keep going.
"Son of Arphaxad, son of Shem, the son of Noah, the son of Lamech, the son of Methuselah, the son of Enoch, the son of Jared, the son of Mahalalel, the son of Canaan, the son of Enosh, the son of Seth, the son of Adam, the son of Hel."
Wait a minute. Where's the break? There's no break. This is in your Bibles, folks. There is no break. Adam is the son of God. Seth is the son of Adam. Likeness, image, naming. Likeness, image, naming. The only word that is different is created versus fathered or begat. So the means shifted, but the relationship is the same. Seth is the first child to have ever had his relationship with his grandfather broken and to not see his grandpa. We are not a project for God. We are not pets. we are not an army of angels who will sing to him and worship him. We are his children. He begat us. He fathered us in his likeness and image, and he named us, and he gave us capacity to name. And then we fathered in likeness and image and had the capacity to name. And Seth fathered in likeness and image. We are not an experiment. We're the kids who went bad. And so, once the creation is perfectly gifted to us, comes the fall. And the creation and the fall are the two doctrines that are the source of all doctrines. And every flaw in your teaching and your theology and your thinking and your emotional self-management and your reading of other people and your reading of yourself and your explanation of the universe and why stuff happens in your life and in your church is distorted to the degree that you get the doctrine of the creation wrong and the doctrine of the fall wrong. Everything else hangs on those. And we've talked a little about the doctrine of the creation, which is the creation comes out of the magnanimity of God. It comes out of the exploding heart of the love of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit. And we don't believe that. And so all of the time we're trying to buy off God, we're trying to impress God, we're trying to please God, and we're trying to avoid God. With our two natures, we love God and we don't ever want to see him. We really want to please him in the way that no natural child would ever be want to be pleasing their parent. You know, if you're my dad and I go, "Oh, Dad, you are worthy and glorious and I just want to obey you," he's probably going to go, "Slap, get out, go and play football." Like, that's not what you want from your kids, right? What do you want from your kids? You want relationship. You want them to jump on your lap for fun without thinking about it. And you want them to thrive. You want them to dance. You want them to go and play football. You want them to go and have pleasure. You want them to come home and say, Guess what? I drew this terrible drawing, but I want you to put it on the fridge. And you go and put it on the fridge and you go, "Oh." And then the kid runs off and forgets they're even halfway through a sentence with you or you were talking to them. And that's 100 times more interesting and more fun as a wicked earthly parent than it is than you think of God wanting stuff from us. So all of our theology about God is always contaminated by this idea that God is not at least as good as us on our best day. That he's busy wanting something, that he wants us to perform in a particular way rather than to take his love for granted. Now that's a strange way of saying it. If your child doesn't take your love for granted, what's that like for you? It's almost awful. Now, the minute, because of sin, you say to your kids, "Look, don't take me for granted." But that's because of sin, that's because of distortion. But our joy is in the life of our kids, that when our kids thrive, we're happy. We go, my kid over there. And we just cannot ever take it in that God loves us like that. That God loves us the way the Father loves the Son already. And he always did and he always will. And his only plot is to get us home. And with the fall, we tell the story of our doctrine of the fall is so fallen. Every time we tell the story of sin in the gospel, we distort it. Let me tell you a little quick spiel about the gospel. You ready? In the beginning was the creation of the world, and God put man in the garden, and he said, he planted a tree in the middle of the garden. He said, don't eat of this tree or you will surely die. Adam and Eve, the serpent sneaks in, Adam and Eve took the fruit, ashamed, they've guilt, and now they've broken God's law, they have to die. But God loved them and he was going to find a way to redeem them. And so, but he's a king, the punishment must be paid, the law must be fulfilled. And so he figures, I'm going to send the Son, Jesus. Jesus is going to come and stand in for humanity, for our sin. He'll take the punishment, the law will be fulfilled. The punishment will fall on Jesus instead of us. Jesus, by the Spirit, includes us into his kingdom, and we become able to live with God forever. We're safe from hell and we get to be in heaven forever. Okay, what I just told you is a satanic perversion of the gospel. I'm going to do it again. I'll do it a bit slower. I want you to hear Satan. You ready? In the beginning, God created the world. He put Adam and Eve in the garden. He planted a tree in the middle of the garden. He said, do not eat of this tree. If you eat of this, you'll surely die. They ate of the tree in the middle of the garden. They shall surely die. God's law is now broken. The punishment must be paid. The king's rule must be upheld. There must be a death. Jesus replaces our death. Da, da, da. I did it again. You missed it. I'm going to go really, really slow. Listen. God created the world, put Adam and Eve in it. He planted a tree in the middle of the garden. He said, bingo. I told you the gospel on Satan's terms. I made you think what Satan made Eve think, which is that the tree in the middle of the garden is the tree of knowledge of good and evil. It's not. If you're filthy rich and you build an architectural garden, what do you put in the middle of it? You've got fountains and hedges and garden beds and so on. What's right in the middle? The coolest thing, right? You put the statue or the sculpture or the monster fountain or whatever it is. The best thing goes in the middle. And in Genesis 2, what's the thing in the middle of the garden? It's the tree of life. The tree of life. What's God's intention? What's the center of his garden? The tree of life. That's what God is all about. He's not all about good and evil. God also planted the tree of the knowledge of good and evil in the garden, right by it. And we think, oh, well, you know, that's a test. You go, wait a minute, you parents, do you set up tests like that around your house? Like, I'll call Social Security, what's the Department of Child Correction, if you're setting up tests around your house for your kids. Like, I'll put a little rat trap here behind the kitchen, just in case the kids go for the cookies, you know? That's sick. That's perverted. And
those videos on YouTube.
Yeah, a mousetrap maybe, but not a rat trap. We think of God as setting the tree as a test, which is just sick. And we tell the gospel that way, that we have broken the law and now punishment must be paid. Center of God's will, center of God's story, the narrative of the gospel is around the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. It's not. It's around the tree of life. God put the tree of life in the garden, and what did he say? You may akal akal. You may eat squared of any tree in the garden. Except for the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Satan already ate from that. And kids, you don't want to eat it. But it's not here as a test for you. It's here as a pledge for you. And here it is. My intention for you is life. The center of my garden is life. I have given you everything that exists. You are my children. I love you. You have free access, akal akal, to the tree of life, and you shall live forever. But I will never hold you here as slaves. I will never hold you here as captives. You are my children. You're not my dogs. You're not my servants. You're not my staff. You're my own children. So I will never enslave you. I will never degrade you. You may always leave. If you leave, it is certain death, because there is no other tree. There is no other river. There is no other life. And Satan went there, and he is beyond redemption. don't you dare eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, for on the day you eat of it, you will surely die. But I will not have this garden locked, because I want you as my children. So the tree of knowledge of good and evil is a memorial of God's goodness in giving us genuine capacity, genuine choice, genuine meaningfulness to our lives, is that we can always choose hell and saw our own heads off. We're not his slaves, we're his kids. As your kids grow up and they start to leave home and so on, you have that tension about whether they'll come back or not, and so sometimes you don't want them to come back for a while, but you kind of, like, you want them to thrive and you want them to come back, but you want them to go away again, but you want them to come back, but you don't want to have them held, and you want them to fly, and you don't want them to go and kill themselves and be idiots and destroy their lives, so you're terribly anxious. And when they're in that kind of mode, you don't want them to come back this week, especially with, yeah, but you actually want them to do wonderfully. You want them to do gloriously. And you want to maintain relationship with them, that you still exist in their world. And so the gospel, when we tell the gospel as the breaking of God's holy law, there is a king, the punishment must be paid, we've just set God up as this beast. He's not a father, he's a despot, he's a king. My law got broken? Right, there's going to be blood. I demand blood, I need a cup of blood, and it's going to be yours. Jesus comes, no, Father, I'll do it for you. Okay, as long as I get my cup of blood, it can be from my own son, that'll be fine. And so we tell the gospel on Satan's terms. And because we do that by nature, see, we've all got the software. We all drank the cordial. Again, we can't perceive of what happened at the fall. And every day, in every way, we underestimate the fall. If it was true that the center of God's will was the tree of knowledge of good and evil, and we've broken the law and the punishment must be paid, then what does God want? He wants purity, righteousness, holiness, good deeds. And he wants submission, just like we would. He wants to dominate everybody, and that his kingdom would work on his terms, and that the job of us is to deliver whatever it is that this king wants to appease him. Oh, thank goodness, finally Jesus has delivered whatever the king wants. We're off the hook. It's a bit sad that we have to go and live with the king forever and ever. Oh, but it'll be all right, because heaven's supposed to be good. You see, it's got just disease in it through and through. What happened at the fall was much, much worse than that we broke God's law and disobeyed him and ate of the tree. Like, that was bad. That was worthy of death eternally, sure. But we did much worse than that. Did we break God's law? Absolutely. Did we break God's heart? 1,000 times more. As a dad, if your kids are entrusted with something that you really want them to be glorious with, you really want to see them come through, and they betray you, and go against everything that you've tried to teach them, and everything you've tried to model for them, and everything you've explicitly entrusted them with, and they don't just crash the car, they deliberately crash the car. They set fire to it. Or they run over your wife. It's that kind of a scare. It's the total betrayal. What happened in the fall was that the kids betrayed Dad's trust. So in breaking the law, I think I mentioned so with my kids when they need some money, they say, Dad, can I have some money? I do this for them. I say, yeah, go for it. And I turn away and I go into another room somewhere. And so they want 10 bucks or 5 bucks or 20 bucks or something. And there might be 500 bucks in the wallet. And I never watch them and I never check. Because I want my kids to know that I walked out of the room and that I implicitly trusted them with my wealth in a way that I'm not going to be able to tell whether they steal it from me. And if I later discover that my kids stole the money, have they broken the law? Big time, right? They've stolen. That's certain death or worse. But what's my primary experience here? I've been doing this for years with my kids. What happens when I actually find out there's $100 in one of my kids' rooms, or they've just spent something I knew they didn't have any money, or it's gone? What's the primary experience for me? My trust is broken.
Betrayed.
I've been betrayed.
Sorrow.
I'm sorrow. I'm heartbroken because my kid. I thought we. See, it's not about the money. It's not about the law breaking. It's about the relationship is trashed. When the flood came, God destroyed every living thing off the earth with the flood. And why did he destroy every living thing off the earth with the flood? Well, because every living thing had become full of sin, only evil all the time, and he was angry with sin on the earth and with mankind, and he destroyed them. Please open your Bibles and read how I just lied to you. I lied to you. You've got to pick this. Three times the Bible shows that I lied to you right then. Genesis 6. Could someone read 6 verse 6?
The Lord grieved that
he... Sorry, 6 verse 4. 6 verse...
Back to 4?
Yeah.
That's Nephilim were on the
earth. Okay, 5. Verse 5. Listen to 5.
The Lord saw how great man's wickedness on earth had become, and that every inclination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil all the time.
Can you stop there? Can you hear the grammar? Anybody good at grammar? What's going on there with the grammar? It's horrible.
And it's growing worse.
It's
going to grow exponentially. This evil isn't going to end if you don't do something.
Yes. This is an infection. So bad, it's an exponential infection. Every thought of the inclinations of his heart, the turning of his heart, was only evil all of the time. Squared, cubed. And now, because what's happened here is that when Adam and Eve stole the fruit, broke God's law, here's a little bit of hideous reminding from the counselling industry. I'm a counsellor, that's my profession. When children are abused by a stranger, it trashes the relationship between the child and the parents. Because the child has been seduced, and the child has listened to a voice that is not their parents' voice, and it has all of the markers of trust. The child is groomed by the seducer, and the molester uses the phrases of the parents to schmooze the child and bamboozles the child and says, here's a candy, but don't tell your mother. Da, 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 da. And as the seduction happens and the molestation happens, even if the relationship between the parents and the kids is really healthy in the first place, The similarity between the molester's mood, style, size, voice, reassurance, so on, is such that it contaminates backwards into the relationship between the parents and the child. And the child's then got this little double checking system going on. But that's what the other guy said. But what if, and you can't get the software out because it's installed. And human software never uninstalls, it only gets written over. And what's happened in the garden is that the serpent is a child molester. And these are the kids, and they're innocent. They're so innocent that they're naked and unashamed. And the child molester comes in and says, you know, Dad's really holding out. I've got something that Dad's holding out on. And, you know, come over here, trust me. And, oh, no, he doesn't mean that. He won't worry because, really, you're not going to die. He's actually holding out some goodies for you. And they take the injection. They drink the virus. And the software is in and is never going to come out. It doesn't ever come out. It's now installed. They don't trust Dad anymore. And Dad hasn't done a thing to deserve the fact that they're literally hiding in the bushes when Dad comes back. And he says, where are you? And they're caught. Well, I was afraid because I was naked, so I hid. God utters some strange Hebrew sentences. What? What do you mean? Like, as if he doesn't know. And it's implied, it's a rhetorical question. Did you eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil that I told you not to eat of? And Adam, his son, his firstborn son, his own image, the one he named, says, she did it. And Eve says, the serpent did it. Now here's in the Hebrew, when Eve is asked what happened, she says, the serpent caused me to forget, and I ate. The serpent caused me to forget. You can translate that as bamboozled, seduced. The serpent put a blender in my mind. And what did she forget? In Genesis 2, when Eve answers Satan, she says, God said, we're allowed to eat of the trees in the garden, but we're not allowed to eat of this one or we'll die. Here's what she does. Watch this. When she quotes Genesis 2, she removes the word delicious. She removes the word beautiful. She removes the word eat abundantly. She calls Yahweh God instead of Yahweh, which is a name. And she says that the tree of the knowledge of good and evil is in the middle of the garden, is the tree in the middle of the garden. Do you notice the pattern there? There's no beauty, there's no delicious, there's no freely eating, there's no father with a name, and the geography of the garden is now rearranged. That's what the serpent did with her thinking. Put a blender in her ear. And so later she says, he caused me to forget. What was the seduction of the fruit? Well, it was beautiful to the eyes. Wait a minute. What was in Genesis 2? Every single tree was made beautiful to the eyes explicitly. The whole phrase is there. And then the next seduction was delicious to the taste. What did she forget? Explicitly in Genesis 2, every single fruit was delicious to the taste. So she has had her mind, I'm trying not to use a rude word, she's had her mind messed up by the serpent. She's taken the virus. They've both taken the injection. They now have serpent virus. They now have, their DNA now has some rodent in it. And when the early fathers, early church fathers, Athanasius and so on, were talking about the fall, they said that what happened at the fall was the breaking of God's law, yes, the breaking of the command of God. But human nature became disintegrated. It was the fall of human nature as a species. we became deranged. We got rabies. And we think, here's some bad fall theology, we think, well, Adam and Eve didn't die because, look, they lived for another hundreds of years, yeah? And so God must have held off on their death. No, we died. He swore, if you eat of this tree, you'll surely die. We died as a species. And when... excuse me. It's like I've got a radio, and it's got FM and AM, and one day the FM died. Now my radio still works. I can pick up AM. It's great. Listen, you can turn it loud, soft, tone, volume. But it doesn't pick up an entire reality anymore. And I've heard one person say that what happened is that if you have a cat, your cat knows that you exist, your cat loves you, your cat can purr and sit on your lap and bite you on the hand and eat your food all the time and come and go as it pleases, right? So the cat completely knows that you exist. But the cat can't listen to bark. And the cat can't talk to you about its day, and you can't talk to the cat about its day. Or better still, the cat can talk to you about the day, but you can't talk to it. Because the cat is dumb. It hasn't got FM. It's only got AM. And the cat, we became, as it were, we went from being humans to cats when we ate the fruit. We became stupidified. We became unable to talk on God's wavelength as his own children, in his own likeness and in his own image. And so we literally are hiding in the bushes, afraid of the owner. Because we can't speak, we're not on his wavelength anymore. We don't get him. We don't actually understand him at all. He's talking blah, 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 and there's nothing. There's nothing. We know he exists. Oh my goodness, look at him. He's terrifyingly huge and he's got powers we don't understand. And where's the cat bowl? But we died. The cat lived on for hundreds of years. We all live on. We all have lives. We all breed and so on. But we're all now a species down. And we have become an intrinsically... Paul says we are born dead in our trespasses and sins. We are by nature what? Sinful and unclean, objects of wrath. We need some food. Okay, I'll finish up. Here we go. So we are now a species fallen. We're now an order of being that is permanently screwed up, unable to receive God, unable to hear his voice, unable to do anything other than know God as a cat knows its owner. And so when... so now we're in Genesis 5. Did you hear? Every thought of the inclination of man's heart is only evil all of the time. The species have become feral cats. And there is nothing in their brain that is not infected with rabies. And so listen to the wrath of God. You ready? Can you read the next verse? Here's the anger of God. You listen to it? Here it comes.
Sorry, I've been somewhere else.
Sorry, here we go.
What was it, 6?
6:6, listen.
The Lord grieved that he had made man on the earth, and his heart was filled with pain.
Stop. Did you hear that? That's the best news of judgment you'll ever hear. What's God's motive? What's his feeling? The Lord was grieved. Grief? That he had made man on the earth, and his heart was what? Filled with rage. Filled with pain. Why? Because he had children. And now he has cats. Well, these are not good cats. These cats have only evil in them. And then... can you read the next two verses? Because that was twice, by the way, that the motive of God for the flood is sorrow. And just in case you missed the two, can you keep reading?
The Lord said, I will wipe mankind whom I've created from the face of the earth, men and animals, creatures that move along the ground.
Why?
The air.
Why?
For I am grieved that I've made them.
For I'm grieved. My heart is filled with pain. Because these were my kids. And so the problem that we have as a species now, as the human race, is not merely that we've broken God's law and the punishment must be paid and someone has to pay the blood so God can drink it. The problem is that we are permanently on spaceship Earth as feral cats, although that's actually flattering. We are reptilian. The Bible's much more clear about that we are reptilian. We are by nature objects of evil and objects of wrath. And we have serpent DNA inside of our species that can never be taken away. And we're born dead. Now, in that context, our problem is not just that we've broken the law. If we've become non-human, we've become subhuman, we've become degraded, we're actually a species lost. And what can a species lost do about itself? Nothing. And so we shall now break and have a coffee and eat.